All right, Exodus 28 tonight. It's a little bit of a long chapter in terms of verses, but we'll take it in relatively big chunks. Just as a reminder, where are we? We're at the top of Mount Sinai. We're at the top of Mount Sinai, which is where we have been for some time, and we will be there through Exodus 31. This is part of the vision that God gives to Moses. He has told Moses on multiple occasions already to take care and make sure that Moses creates all of the things that God shows to him in exactly the way he has shown them. Right, and so tonight we will see in Exodus chapter 28 the garments of the priests. Picking up in verse 1, God speaking to Moses. Then bring near to yourself Aaron your brother and his sons with him from among the sons of Israel to minister as priests to me, Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. And you shall speak to all the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as priest to me. And these are the garments which they shall make: a breastpiece and an ephod, and a robe, and a tunic of checkered work, a turban, and a sash. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister as priest to me. And they shall take the gold, and the blue, and the purple, and the scarlet material, and the fine linen. So let's pause there. So this is the setup for the whole chapter, right? The first five verses. Okay? So the first thing we see here is that Aaron, Moses' brother, is being called as priest, high priest, specifically in Aaron's case, for the nation Israel. Okay, so a couple of things about that. Number one, the first thing we see is that it's going to be a priesthood based on lineage. Okay, so we see Aaron called as the first Israelite high priest, and we see his sons being called, right, his progeny that will be called generation after generation after generation as part of what we call the Aaronic priesthood. Okay, so A-A-R-O-N-I-C, the priesthood that begins with Aaron. So this is a familial priesthood. All right. The second thing we're going to see, we see here, is that Aaron was called as priest. Okay, he's called as priest, and that'll be important as we wrap up the chapter. All right, but Aaron is called by God, by Yahweh himself, to be high priest. The third thing we should see is that prior to this call of Aaron, and prior to the establishment of the nation Israel, the heads of the households functioned as the priests. Right? So for example, one explicit example is you could go to Job chapter 1. And in Job chapter 1, Job's sons and daughters gathered together and they would have these feasts, right? And Job would rise up early the next morning and he would offer a sacrifice for what purpose? Just in case his children had sinned. Right? And so we see prior to the establishment of the nation Israel, we see that the spiritual head of the household, the father, was the priest. And now we see God acting in a slightly different way. He's now calling a high priest that represents not just the individual households, but represents the entire nation. All right? And we'll come back to that at the end, Lord willing. So those are three things I want you to see in verse 1. One is that Aaron is called. Two, Aaron's progeny continues on the priesthood. And number three, Aaron is called as high priest of now an entire nation whom God has redeemed out of slavery in Egypt. Okay? Very important. Verse 2, you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. Right? So we're going to see the rest of the chapter, these garments, which God is going to describe, and they are very beautiful, very ornate garments, and they are to represent the glory and beauty of Yahweh. Yes, and of grace, right? Yahweh and His grace. All right? And so this is very important. Verse 3, you shall speak to all the skillful persons. So there were people who were specially endowed with gifts to create these ornate garments, which will be described in the rest of the chapter. Later in verse 3, they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, to sanctify him, to purify him, to call him, to set him apart. All right? And we shall see at the end of the chapter that this is in comparison to Jesus in his high priestly ministry. God calls Aaron to be sanctified. Jesus in John 17:19 says, "I sanctify myself." Okay? I sanctify myself. So there's going to be a lot of comparison and contrasting of the priestly ministries of Aaron and Jesus tonight. That's where we're headed. All right? Verse 4, "These are the garments which they shall make. There are six of them, a breastpiece, an ephod, a robe, a tunic, a turban, and a sash." Right? Six different pieces of the garments here identified in verse 4. We will see them all expanded upon as we move through the chapter. Verse 5, "They shall take the gold and the blue and the purple and the scarlet." Now, the blue and the purple of the scarlet, this is clearly linen material. Gold is not a linen material. Gold is a metal. But you can turn gold into a linen material by hammering it, right, and turning it into a yarn-like substance. And so we have this metallic gold, which we had previously seen inside the tabernacle tent, right, that is now being woven into the garments of the high priest. All right, and we'll see that again and again as we move through the chapter, picking up in verse 6 with the ephod. "They shall also make the ephod of gold, of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, the work of the skillful workman. It shall have two shoulder pieces joined to its two ends that it may be joined. And the skillfully woven band which is on it shall be like its workmanship, of the same material, of gold, of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. And you shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on the one stone, and the names of the remaining six on the other stone, according to their birth. As a jeweler engraves a signet, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel. You shall set them in filigree settings of gold. And you shall put the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of memorial for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for a memorial. And you shall make filigree settings of gold, and two chains of pure gold. And you shall make them of twisted cordage work, and you shall put the corded chains on the filigree settings." So, verses 6 through 14, this describes the ephod. Now, the ephod is kind of an apron-looking thing that sort of hangs over the shoulders. I brought, if you have a study Bible, perhaps you have a picture. I brought a couple of pictures that I will pass around in these separate directions. Okay?
Great.
So the ephod is kind of the apron that's hanging down over top of the shoulders of the high priest.
Yeah, start there.
Okay. All right, so we're talking about the outermost garment. It's made of gold, blue, purple, scarlet material. All right, so it's very ornate. Verse 9, "There are two onyx stones upon which are engraved the names of the sons of Israel." Now, it says onyx in my translation. It may say a different kind of stone in your translation. There are also stones in verses 17, 18, 19, and 20. Most translations, the names of these stones are different. The reality of the situation is that no one really knows exactly what kind of stones they're talking about. What's most important is that we need to understand that they are beautiful gemstones. All right. So again, all as part of the ornate, the ornate garments of the high priest, right? These are beautiful gemstones. The two on the shoulders that are described in verses 9 and following, okay? It's two onyx stones engraved in the names of the sons of Israel, right? Six of the names on one stone, as you can see in verse 10, the names of the six on the other stone according to their birth, all right? And so you have them in terms of Reuben, Simeon, and so on. Now, there is some discussion here in verses 9 and 10, and also in verses 17 through 21, right? Both places, in verses 9 and 10 and 17 through 21, it is identified that there are 12 names of the sons of Israel that are engraved on the stones. In verses 9 and 10, we're talking about the ephod. In verses 17 through 21, we're talking about the breastplate itself, okay, which we'll get to in a second. The point I want to point out is in the commentaries, there's some discussion about whether or not Levi's name is included on the stones, okay? Because remember, Levi is going to be set apart, right? And as we go into, say, Joshua later, the Levites don't get any land apportioned to them. And if you remember, Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, are actually make up the 12 tribes that get apportionments of the land. All right, so there's some discussion about whether or not Levi is included here in verses 9 and 10 and also verses 17 through 21. Right? It's very difficult to say. However, it seems like the weight of the evidence is on the fact that, yes, Levi was included. Right? Now, why wouldn't Levi be included? Levi might not be included because Aaron himself is representing the Levites. Okay? But there is some evidence from extra-biblical Jewish writings that Levi was, in fact, included in the 12. And so instead of Ephraim and Manasseh, you would have Joseph. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. We can't say with 100% certainty, but the weight of the evidence seems to be that Levi and Joseph were included, not Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay? Nonetheless, the point is that in verses 9 and 10, these two stones, engraved with the 12 names of the sons of Israel, sit on the shoulders of the high priest. Now, when we get to 17 through 21 and we talk about the breastplate, those 12 stones, they're 12 individual stones, they are actually set in the breastpiece itself. So one should ask, well, why are there stones in the breastpiece and also stones on the shoulders? Okay, there's some discussion of this in the commentaries. Here's actually what I think. What I think is that no matter what position the high priest is in when he is ministering before God, an allowance is made for the sons of Israel, the names of the sons of Israel, to always be within the sight of Yahweh himself. So there are only two positions that the high priest would do ministry on behalf of Israel. What are they? Well, the first one is he would be standing. And the other one would be that he would be worshiping, right? Or prostrate on the ground. In both of those cases, the sons of Israel are always looking, they are before the face of God. Mm-hmm. Okay? So when the high priest bows down, the breastplate, which is actually attached to the ephod, we'll see that, okay, in verses like 22 and following, right? But the sons of Israel are now facing the ground, but on his shoulders, they are before the face of God. Yeah. Okay? That's my particular take on why there are two sets of names. Mm-hmm. All right? They are to be engraved, as we see in verse 11. Filigree is something that when I was first reading through the Bible, I had to, you know, I'm a guy. I have no idea what filigree is, but apparently women know. Maybe just, they're just born with this kind of information. But basically, this would be an ornate decorative setting. Okay, something in which the stones would sit. Kind of almost a cage. In many cases, it looks like a kind of a cage that you would set the stone inside so it doesn't fall. Okay, so it's a gold, made out of gold. It's an ornate, decorative setting in which the stone would sit. Okay? And so in verse 12, we see that these two stones are on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as a memorial for the sons of Israel, and Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for a memorial. So the high priest, remember, the high priest does not go into the most holy place on the Day of Atonement for himself only. What is a priest? Reminder. What is a priest? A priest is a man who represents the people to God. Right? So he's going in there not just for himself, but he's going in there to be the representative of the Israelites before the covenant God of Israel, Yahweh. All right? That's in contrast to a prophet. Right? A prophet represents God to the people. The priest represents the people to God. So he's always walking around. When the high priest is doing his ministry, he's always walking around and he's always carrying the sons of Israel with him at all times. Very important. Verse 13, filigree settings of gold, two chains of pure gold, you shall make them of twisted cordage work, and you shall put the cordage chains on the filigree settings. So there's chains up here on the shoulders, right, that are in some sense holding the ephod together and holding the filigree settings in the ephod. Right? So they won't fall. That is the ephod. Verses 15 through 30, okay, so the bulk of the section here in Exodus 28 is going to be dealing with the breast piece. So on the pictures that I pass around, or if you have a study Bible, the breast piece is hanging here, and it has 12 stones in it. That's the breast piece. All right, so here we go, verse 15. And you shall make a breastpiece of judgment, the work of a skillful workman, like the work of the ephod you shall make it, of gold, of blue, and purple, and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen you shall make it. And it shall be square and folded double, a span in length and a span in width. And you shall mount on it four rows of stones. The first row shall be a row of ruby, topaz, and emerald. And the second row a turquoise, a sapphire, and a diamond. And the third row a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst. And the fourth row a beryl, and an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold filigree. And the stones shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names. They shall be like the engravings of a seal, each according to his name for the 12 tribes. And you shall make on the breastpiece chains of twisted cordage work in pure gold. And you shall make on the breastpiece two rings of gold, and shall put the two rings on the two ends of the breastpiece. And you shall put the two cords of gold on the two rings at the ends of the breastpiece. And you shall put the other two ends of the two cords on the two filigree settings, and put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod at the front of it. And you shall make two rings of gold, and shall place them on the two ends of the breastpiece, on the edge of it, which is toward the inner side of the ephod. And you shall make two rings of gold, and put them on the bottom of the two shorter pieces of the ephod, on the front of it, close to the place where it is joined, above the skillfully woven band of the ephod. And they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod, with a blue cord, that it may be on the skillfully woven band of the ephod, and that the breastpiece may not come loose from the ephod. Verse 29, and Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place for a memorial before their Lord continually. Verse 30, and you shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. And Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. Verse 15, it's a breastplate of judgment. And then in verse 30, there are these two things, right? That's the best we can do. The Urim and the Thummim, right? And these are in some way to provide judgment for the sons of Israel. So that's why it's called the breastplate of judgment, or the breastpiece of judgment, because not only are the 12 stones of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece, but the Urim and the Thummim are in some way also in the breastpiece. And we'll get to that when we get to verse 30 as we work our way back through. Okay, so it's a breastpiece of judgment. And it's like the ephod in that it is ornate. It is made of gold, of blue, and purple, and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen. Verse 15. Verse 16, very important. It is a square and folded double, a span in length and a span in width. Right? So, why is it folded? It's folded because it's a pouch. That's what it is.
Where is it folded?
You can't see it. It's folded. So it's created to be a square, mm-hmm. But then it's folded over on itself so that you can put something inside of it. Mm-hmm. So the stones, the 12 stones, mm-hmm. are on the outside. They are always continually before the face of Yahweh. But it's mm-hmm. folded in such a way that you can put something inside. It's a pouch. Mm-hmm. Okay? You mount it, sure. You mount it on four rows of stones, right? And so, as I mentioned, in 17 through 20, there's 12 kinds of gemstones here. The translations are probably different for you. That's not the point. The point is they're beautiful stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel. And as I made the case earlier, it's most likely that Levi and Joseph were included as part of the 12. Okay? As we get past 22 and following, this is how the breast piece is attached to the ephod, so that when the high priest is worshiping, that is, he is prostrate on the ground, the breast piece stays in place with cords and rings. And it's all made of fine twisted linen and gold, right? Very ornate and very secure, which is good. It's good when your high priest is carrying you around before the face of God and you're nice and secure there.
Pastor, did he have to wear this all the time?
No. No, that's a good question. So did he have to wear this all the time? As we move through Exodus and then especially into Leviticus, we will see that the high priest did not wear these garments all the time. He would take them off at certain times, and then before he had to put them back on, he would have to wash himself in the basin and then put them on again to do his ministry, specifically on the Day of Atonement. Okay? So he wore them more often than that, but this was not something like he slept in and that sort of thing. This is an excellent question. He only wore the garments when he was about the ministry of the people. Alright?
Thank you.
Excellent question. Okay, so I don't want to go back through necessarily 22 through 28, because again, this is how the breastpiece is fastened onto the ephod. But in verse 29, and Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place for a memorial before the Lord continually. So we saw that back in verse 12, and now we see it in verse 29, that the names of the Israelites are being carried by the Israelite high priest as a memorial before Yahweh. Okay? He's never just doing ministry on his own behalf. Now, there will be a time when he has to make a sacrifice on his own behalf, as we look at Leviticus 16 when we eventually get there, the Day of Atonement. You can go there yourself for study. So he does have to make a sacrifice on his own behalf. Why? Because he's a sinner. Mm-hmm. He's in need of atonement. But then he also makes a sacrifice on behalf of the people whom he represents, which is the nation Israel, the 12 tribes. Verse 30. Here we go. First mention of these two things. You shall put in the breastpiece of judgment. That's why we saw it being a pouch. You shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and the Thummim. And they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before Yahweh. And Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. Here's the reality. Okay? We do not know what these are exactly. Okay? Most commentators believe that they were additional stones. Two additional stones. Okay? And the reason why most commentators believe that they are two additional stones is because, for several reasons. Number one, the breast piece is a pouch. So it's implied that something would be put inside the pouch. Okay, that's number one. Number two, later during the history of the Old Testament, you will find on the rarest of occasions that someone's seeking an answer from the Lord and they don't get it. And this has caused some commentators to speculate that perhaps the Urim and Thummim functioned, so imagine a heads and a tails. Mm. So if you get two heads, you get a clear answer. If you get two tails, you get a clear answer. If you get a head and a tail, God's not speaking. Okay? And so you can read that in the commentaries, and they'll refer to a couple of places in the Old Testament. For example, King Saul, right, who was the king before David, he can't get a clear answer. And it may be because of the way the Urim and Thummim were functioning in that moment. Okay?
Pastor Steve.
Yes?
The 1560 Geneva, just in the notes, says that the Verum signifies light and the Thummim signifies perfection. Did you come across that?
Yes, so that's so you should have, most Bibles, including mine, have a textual note that Urim means lights and Thummim means perfections. Now, so I appreciate the comment. I was on my way there, right? And the reason why that's important is because it has actually caused some commentators to believe that the Urim and Thummim were not actual physical things. Okay? But that Aaron carried with him over his heart or in his heart lights and perfections, so that when Aaron went into the tabernacle, or the high priest went into the temple to seek the face of God on behalf of Israel, right, that he would receive the word from God, and the fact that he was there and he had all of these garments on was reflected of lights and perfections, that is illumination from God, right, and the perfections of the sacrifices that were supporting and upholding the priesthood of Israel. Okay? So the literal translations are important here and cause even more, a little bit more confusion about exactly what these Urim and Thummim are. Okay? I don't think that it's that big of a deal for multiple reasons. We as New Covenant believers, we don't need Urim and Thummim. We have the Holy Spirit. We have the mind of Christ. This was clearly, okay, the Urim and Thummim were clearly, whatever they were, whether they were actual physical stones or they were just representative of what Aaron was carrying with him when he went in to minister on behalf of the people of Israel, it was clearly for a time. The time of the Mosaic Covenant. And it points us to the high priestly work of Jesus Christ himself, who is the light of the world, and in him all perfections reside. Okay? So, like the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat and the other furniture in the tabernacle, the Urim and the Thummim are not things A, we have anymore, and B, need anymore. Okay? We don't have the high priestly garments. We don't have any of that because we don't need it. We don't need any of it. Okay? So, as sort of odd as these things are, they did actually live on later. You can read them in the narrative of the Old Testament, right? But they are a little bit enigmatic to us because we can't see them. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, they're lost to the annals of Jewish history. Okay? So, excellent comment. Verse 31. We're going to move on to the robe. 31 to 35. And you shall make the robe of the ephod all of blue. And there shall be an opening at its top in the middle of it. Around its opening there shall be a binding of woven work, as it were, the opening of a coat of mail, that it may not be torn. And you shall make on its hem pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet material all around on its hem, and bells of gold between them all around. A golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate, all around on the hem of the robe. And it shall be on Aaron when he ministers, and its tinkling may be heard when he enters and leaves the holy place before the Lord, that he may not die. So, in the picture that I passed around, you can see the blue robe that is underneath the ephod, which is underneath the breastplate. Okay? Very important garment. On it is pomegranates. So, pomegranates, I think, hearken us back to the garden. Remember, the tabernacle, one of the pictures, one of the types, one of the shadows, is a return to Eden as we head west through the tabernacle tent. Right, the doors are on the east side. You head in through the veil, the curtain, and then the veil. You're heading back into Eden. And so in Leviticus 16, on the Day of Atonement, one day a year, the high priest enters back into the garden, into God's presence. And so the pomegranates representative of that. And also bells. Very interesting. Very interesting. That the high priest, remember, he's the only one who's allowed to go into the most holy place. How do you know that the high priest is alive in there? Because you can hear him. Okay? The bells are representative of the fact that the high priest is alive and he's well and he's working and he's ministering on behalf of the people. Again, this would give the Israelites great assurance that God would accept their sacrifice again this year. And our great high priest is alive and well. And although he's not doing ministry, standing and doing ministry, he's seated at the right hand of the Father. We clearly have in the bells of the high priestly garments the types and shadows of a risen Savior and risen high priest who is alive and at this very moment making intercession for us. And this should give us great assurance. Go read Hebrews. Great.
I'm sorry, Pastor.
That's fine, you're fine.
Is this where I've heard somewhere online that they would tie a rope around them, and if you know,
just in case, right? So right. Jewish tradition holds, and by the way, that's nowhere in the text.
Okay.
It's nowhere in the text, but Jewish tradition holds that they would not. The high priest would put on his garments, and he would have the bells, and they would tie a rope around his ankle, so that just in case they stopped hearing the bells, they could only assume that he had been killed by Yahweh for any number of reasons, which Yahweh would have been justified to kill him. And so they would use the rope to then pull out the high priest out of the most holy place because nobody else wanted to go in there either. Mm-hmm. Okay? Right? So that is Jewish tradition, not sanctioned in the inspired text. Right? So whether or not that's true or not, I have read over the years that some people say that it is and some people say that it isn't. It's not abundantly clear to me. And it's not in the text.
Okay?
Thanks. Yeah, sure, no problem. Okay? But if the bells stop tinkling, he's in trouble. All right? Verse 36, we move on to the plate. Verses 36 through 38. You shall also make a plate of pure gold and shall engrave on it, like the engravings of a seal, holy to the Lord. And you shall fasten it on a blue cord, and it shall be on the turban, and it shall be at the front of the turban. And it shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall take away the iniquity of the holy things which the sons of Israel consecrate with regard to all their holy gifts. And it shall always be on his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord. So this gold plate, it literally says, holy to the Lord, okay? And what it's doing is a constant reminder before God that Aaron is the one whom he has called, and that the sacrifices that Aaron has made and carries with him sanctify the people and all of their deeds. All of their deeds. Okay? So the people are holy, because the high priest is holy. There's a golden plate on his forehead that declares him to be holy. And he's declared to be holy not because he is righteous in himself, but because God has declared him to be so. Do you see that? God is laying out the stipulation for the gold plate. God himself is declaring the high priest to be holy. Which is the only reason why the sacrifices and the people are holy. All right? Do you see that? Verse 38. Aaron shall take away the iniquity of the holy things which the sons of Israel consecrate. What is that? That's everything. That's the furniture. That's the tabernacle. That's the courtyard. That's the altar. That's the basin. That's the sacrifices. That's the works of righteousness, so-called religious righteousness, that the Israelites bring as an offering to God. It's all made holy because the high priest has been declared to be holy. Our works under the new covenant are not holy, but they are sanctified by Christ. Okay? They are not the basis of our righteousness before God, but because we have a righteous one before God, He sanctifies the rest of it, including our very selves. Okay? There must always be a holy mediator. That's what the gold plate is for. A constant reminder to God that He had called a holy high priest who sanctifies everything else. Verse 39, you shall weave the tunic of checkered work of fine linen, and shall make a turban of fine linen, and you shall make a sash, the work of a weaver. So this closes out the remaining of the six pieces of clothing that we saw all the way back in verse 4. Not a lot of detail, obviously. I would note, however, that in verse 39, there's a sash. Jesus wears a sash. Where?
When it comes back.
Revelation 1:13. It's wearing a sash. Okay? Verse 40. And for Aaron's sons you shall make tunics, you shall also make sashes for them, and you shall make caps for them for glory and for beauty. You shall put them on Aaron your brother and on his sons with him, and you shall anoint them and ordain them and consecrate them that they may serve me as priests. And you shall make for them linen breeches to cover their bare flesh, and they shall reach from the loins even to the thighs, and they shall be on Aaron and on his sons when they enter the tent of meeting or when they approach the altar to minister in the holy place, so that they do not incur guilt and die. It shall be a statute forever to him and to his descendants after him. Okay? So, Aaron's sons get similar, not identical, but similar garments. Okay? So they don't get a turban with a gold plate, they get caps. But they're for glory and for beauty, because these sons of Aaron are also ministering at the bronze altar. They're also ministering in the holy place, lighting the lampstand, bringing in the bread. Okay? The only place they cannot go is the most holy place. Alright? They have, in verse 42, these linen undergarments, right, to cover their bare flesh. And so this takes us all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, right, where Adam and Eve realized for the first time that they were naked and they were ashamed. So these linen undergarments are for the covering of the priestly shame. Okay, so it reminds us all to be humble and to be modestly attired. Okay, and they shall be on Aaron and on his sons, verse 43, when they enter the tent of meeting, or when they approach the altar to minister in the holy place. That's what I mean, when it wasn't just Aaron and the high priest, you could go into the holy place, so they do not incur guilt and die. So whenever they were doing ministry, they had to wear these special garments. All of them. But especially the high priest. Okay. As I mentioned, this marks a transition in biblical redemptive history from a priestly head of household to a national priesthood. What we then also see with Jesus is that his high priestly ministry goes beyond the nation to what? The ends of the earth. All those who are called and sanctified, both Jews and Gentiles. And so we can see through biblical redemptive history, we see the priesthood starting at the level of the household, be expanded under the Mosaic Covenant as a priesthood for a nation, and then under the New Covenant, a priesthood for men and women from every tribe, language, people, and nation. So we see the high priestly ministry expanding throughout biblical redemptive history. Okay? Moses is not the priest. Moses is a prophet and mediator, right? Aaron is the priest. Right? And so as we think about Jesus Christ and his ministry and his threefold office, a prophet, priest, and king, although we haven't gotten to the king yet, that won't come for quite some time until Samuel, right? But we have the prophet and the priest bound up in Jesus Christ. And those priests, if you read Hebrews chapter 5, specifically verse 4, any priest of God must be called by God. And that's why I emphasized in verse 1 that Aaron and his sons were called by God to be priests. No Danite or Reubenite or Simeonite or Benjaminite could just be a priest. Okay? You had to be called by God. Christ, as the high priest of the new covenant, he is called by God. Where? Psalm 110. Psalm 110. Let's go there. It's so important. A very important text in the New Testament. Psalm 110. This is the calling of Jesus Christ to the high priesthood. This is an interesting psalm because it talks about the kingly nature of Christ as well as the priestly nature. So verse 1, the Lord says to my Lord, so Yahweh says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I might make thine enemies a footstool for thy feet. The Lord will stretch forth thy strong scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of thine enemies. Your people will volunteer freely in the day of your power. In holy array, from the womb of the dawn, thy youth are to thee as the dew. This is the kingly portion of Psalm 110. Verse 4, the Lord has sworn, Yahweh has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Jesus, and the epistle to the Hebrews will pick up on Psalm 110. Jesus is a priest called by God, but not in the order of Aaron. It's a completely new order, the order of Melchizedek. Reminder, Jesus was not a Levite. What was he? What tribe? Judah. It's the lion of the tribe of Judah, Genesis 49. And the Hebrews brings that out. Okay? What are the garments for? The garments represent the holiness of the high priest and the righteousness of the high priest. These are beautiful, ornate, spotless garments, representative of the righteousness that is required in order to enter into the throne room of God. This is why we declare the sinless perfection of Jesus Christ himself. Jesus, as our high priest, he cannot represent us before God unless he himself is righteous. That's what the garments are for. People read through the Old Testament. They get to Exodus 28 and they start to rub their temples and go, what is all of this ornateness? The ornateness is absolutely essential. It is representative of the sinless, perfect righteousness, spotlessness of Jesus Christ, which qualifies him to go into the entrance, into the throne room of God on our behalf. This is not for no reason. And it all points to Jesus. And by the way, the other thing that the high priest could not enter into the throne room of God without was the sacrifice. We know, as we get into Leviticus, that the sacrifices are many and various. And on the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16, the sacrifices that had to be made on behalf of the high priest, as well as the people, that blood had to be carried into the most holy place. Jesus Christ, our great high priest of the new covenant, he doesn't carry the blood of bulls and goats, which can never take away sin. He offers himself, his own blood, as a payment, what the New Testament calls his precious blood, as a payment for our sins, the ones whom he represents. And by the way, the high priest of Israel did not go into the throne room of Yahweh to represent any Canaanite, Edomite, Moabite, any of those other people. Whom did he represent? He represented Israel, God's covenant people, the people whom God had redeemed out of slavery. This is why we believe in the doctrine of particular redemption, limited atonement. Jesus only represents his people before God. Okay? And as Pastor Scott often says, not one drop of the Savior's blood was wasted. It was all spent to cover us, to cover our sins. And it was all effective, just like the Israelite high priest carried the sacrificial blood only for the people whom God had redeemed. The parallelism is there on purpose, and it's clear. And now we, final comment, because I know we went long tonight, but it's a long chapter, sorry. But now we are a royal priesthood. 1 Peter 2:9. Quoting Exodus 19:6, we are a royal priesthood. What do we put on? Well, we put on two things. We put on Christ, our beautiful garment, and we put on the new man, is the exhortation to be sanctified, to be righteous, to be holy, even as God himself is holy. When you read those words in the New Testament, put on Christ, put off the old self, put on the new man, the image you should have in your head is Exodus 28. Because we have been called to be a nation and a kingdom of priests unto our God. We no longer need the veil. And the Day of Atonement, the veil is open, the way is open, and we can, Hebrews 4, walk into the very throne room of God with a humble confidence, knowing that our high priest is already